Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today I'm pleased to announce that we have the special guest, Chris Mooney, joining us for this episode. Chris is the senior correspondent for the American Prospect magazine and the author of two books, including the recent New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science. Chris was also, in 2005, named one of Wired magazine's 10 sexiest geeks, which makes it a shame that he's joining us by Skype instead of in the studio, but there you have it.
Oh, well.
Chris, welcome. I'll just picture how sexy you must be.
So that was 2005.
Yeah, we'll age, my friend. Yeah. Okay, so, Chris, I know that your book has predictably raised quite a bit of controversy. You've got criticism right and left, literally, as in obviously predictably from the right, since those are the people you criticize in the book. But even some commentators on the left, we'll get to that later on, maybe in the episode. The point is, it definitely was controversial. So before we get into the meat of it, what's the basic thesis?
So the Republican brain. The thesis is that in order to understand why left and right can't see eye to eye anymore, and that's obvious to everyone in American politics, but also why the right tends to be actually factually wrong, it's not enough to stick with purely surface level political, historical, sociological explanations, because we've got too much evidence now that liberals and conservatives are just different people on levels of personality, psychological needs, moral systems, all these things that make you respond to events and stimuli in a way that you're not fully consciously aware of. And so it stands to reason, in fact, it would be astonishing if it were not the case, that those things are having a really significant role in our debates over what to do politically, but also in our debates over what's factually true. Given the amount of evidence, and Massimo, I know that you talk about some of this in your own book, given the amount of evidence out there, it's really just hard to ignore it anymore.
So, Chris, what are some examples of issues on which the right tends to be factually wrong?
Oh, well, and this is what got me into this. I mean, I wrote The Republican War on Science in 2005, and there's the whole litany. But if you want to just stick with science, scientific
sure,
topics, although
yeah,
this is not exclusive to science.
If I must.
And you want to stick with things that are completely open and shut.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
And there's no
right.
wiggle room.
Right.
Then we'll take global warming and evolution. You really can't do better than those two.
Right. Okay. So, but the issue is, well, there's several issues. One of which is, let me go back to what you just said a minute ago. So, it is clear, as you say, to everybody that the current situation in American politics is really bad in terms of discourse. I mean, there is no discourse essentially among most people that are supposed to be engaging in politics, which is supposed to be the art of, you know, compromise. They are, in fact, a lot of the time, these people are in fact factually wrong. They're not interested seemingly in hearing the other side and so on and so forth. But it's also true that this is actually a development that is quite recent in America, even in American politics, and certainly it's not a global phenomenon. I mean, there are other places in the world where there is no, or there's not this degree of, at least, of gridlock. So on the face, wouldn't that suggest that a sort of historical, cultural explanation is the proper locus of analysis here? Why do you think that it's not?
I wouldn't say that it's not. I mean, it has always been the form of analysis that has been taken.
Right.
It's a traditional form of journalists, of historians, etc. And I, in the book, spend plenty of time on giving just that sort of analysis. But what I say is that people have ignored what we broadly might call, quote-unquote, nature.
Okay.
But it's hard to see why it wouldn't also be involved. And so, in other words, we've privileged the cultural sociological analysis for a very, very long time.
Right.
But given all of the evidence, it's time to look at what's also going on. And the two are never to the exclusion of one another. They're always complementary.
Right.
So that's my opinion on that.
What are some well-validated features of the psychology of conservatives that you argue contribute to them being factually wrong on these issues?
So there's really just a lot of data. And what is most amazing to me is if you take something like personality, you know, I'm not even aware of a scientific counterargument to the basic idea that liberals and conservatives differ by personality. And if you go by the accepted, widely accepted Big Five scale for measuring personality, it's certainly not the only one, but it's one that has certainly become quite well established. And liberals score a lot higher on the openness to new experiences dimension. Conservatives tend to score higher on the conscientiousness or wanting order and structure and stability in their lives dimension. I mean, that one's, you know, and that ramifies throughout all of your life, from who you date to how you plan your vacations to, it turns out, your dispositions in politics. And, you know, accompanying that analysis are a variety of different related kinds of measurements. You know, there's this well-established construct in psychology called the need for cognitive closure, which is the need to have a fixed idea, a fixed belief, so that you can dispel uncertainty and doubt and have your secure knowledge. And a scale has been developed to test that. And that's one that always gives a right-left difference, you know, with the conservatives more needing the fixed answer and then engaging in patterns of behavior that are related to wanting the fixed answer, like seizing on a fact, seizing on a belief to give the certainty and then not being willing to deviate from it. And that's related to go back to the personality dimension of openness to new experience. I mean, that's very closely related, how open you are to new experiences or how closed you are to new experiences.
So those
psychological traits are at the center of my analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, people have gone farther in recent years with new scientific techniques to try to root some of these things to the extent possible now, which is not very much, in actual analyses of brain structure, function, physiological traits, even trying to go all the way back to genes. And that is the most uncertain science, and it's the newest science. You don't have to bank on it. But on the other hand, it does stand to reason that if these are, you know, aspects of our personality that we're eventually going to find out how they're related to brain function and how they're related to physiological response.
Okay, so on the one hand, I don't seem the claim that there are different personalities that they reflect or they cause in some sense, you know, one's tendencies, political tendencies, one's worldview, and so on and so forth. That seems like, well, it would have to be the case, right? I mean, we have, after all, where do our opinions come from? We're not sort of rationalistic, abstract, analyzers of information. We filter in everything that comes from the outside world through our personality. And our personality surely is the result of these complex interactions between genes, environments. And by environment, of course, I mean largely the cultural environment, but even the physical one, throughout our lives. So that seems rather uncontroversial. The more controversial part, I would guess, if it is interesting, it's, in fact, but it should be rather uncontroversial. The more controversial part should be, okay, to what extent are these personality traits actually flexible or plastic? And you mentioned the word genetics there. And so are we saying, or is the science, as you understanding, saying that these personality traits are actually fairly fixed throughout one's lifetime? And that's the first part of the question. The second part is, even if they are, does that in fact, to what extent does that imply a fixity of opinions? Because one might have the same basic personality, but then filter information from the outside world, throughout his life or her life, and then change one's mind about certain things. So the first question is, you know, how stable is, does the evidence indicate that the personality, what personality actually is throughout a lifetime?
Pretty stable, but it doesn't mean you can't change. Because, my understanding of the research is that personality is something that you don't go from a 1 to a 5 over the course of your life on these kinds of traits. And if you think about some of the other ones that are not as political, but that are just as defining of what a person's like extroversion versus introversion. You know, I mean, people are introverts. People are extroverts. It, you know, they might, you know, an introvert might try to learn how to make small talk to some extent, but generally, I mean, they're never going to be thriving on the energy of other people in the way that an extreme extrovert is mm-hmm. going to be doing. So we're talking about something that really defines you. And that is, broadly speaking, fairly stable, but it doesn't mean people can't change. But then the other part of the question is about the political environment. And so, you know, you take a personality and you stick it in an environment and then you change the environment. What does the personality do? And the right. answer is all kinds of things.
Right.
So, you know, political winds can definitely change people. So, I just don't think there's any real doubt about that.
Just to make sure I understand the point of the question, Massimo, if someone's personality did change over time, that doesn't seem to me like it would undermine the thesis of Chris's book.
No.
If, you know, that could, like, if they become more open to experience over time, maybe that also makes them more open to revising their opinion on factual matters.
Correct. No,
so
that's
is
right.
The issue at stake then, the innate
events
biological.
Could change the personality too. I mean, if you think about, like, 9/11. Which is the classic event that clearly changed politics. And I would argue that it changed politics by working on people's brains. I mean, you know, it instills fear, you know, fear and threat. People are mortally concerned and, you know, they want to batten down the hatches. Mm-hmm. They do not want to indulge in a long and nuanced debate about what we ought to do. They want a leader who's going to take a firm, decisive decision and not think about anything except in terms of black and white. That's how you feel when mm-hmm. you're under threat. And so then that pushes the country towards a rightward shift.
So it sounds like the nature and nurture causes are very intertwined here. That
yeah, and it pushes even liberals to the right, you know, because they're. I mean, it's not like a liberal can't move, and it's not like a conservative.
Oh, I can think
move.
Of the big one.
But the point is that there are psychological factors underlying the kind of ideologies that feel right to us. And interestingly, since the book came out, there's been really great work done on the psychological factors that predispose towards libertarianism, which is something that I didn't talk about. But what's just being shown by Jonathan Haidt and his colleagues is that, you know, you can do it for liberals, you can do it for conservatives, and yes, you can do it for libertarians, mm-hmm. and they look a little different than either liberals or conservatives, but it still works. There's certain traits that predispose one to feeling the way a libertarian feels mm-hmm. about the world.
Yeah, can you break down what you mean by conservative? Are you talking social conservatives? Fiscal conservatives, et cetera?
Well, usually in these studies, they'll do several things. They will ask for self-identification, you know, rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 7 from very liberal to very conservative, mm-hmm. instead of the moderates in the middle. They will ask positions on issues. And so they'll ask social questions and they'll ask economic questions, and then they can determine whether you're social, economic, liberal, or conservative. Sometimes they'll do party identification, too. None of these things are exactly the same. On the other hand, they travel together pretty nicely
in terms of
U.S. politics. So the social conservatives and the economic conservatives tend to be together. Now, granted, we know there are some that aren't, but it's pretty correlated.
Tend to be together.
Same thing with party identification.
Tend to be together in terms of their similarity on the openness to experience scales, et cetera, and their resulting or allegedly resulting similarity on being wrong factually?
Well, so that's two questions. But actually, let me the best study I've seen of this, they do tend to be similar. For example, all three kinds of conservatives are more tend toward being more conscientious, liking order and structure.
Mm-hmm.
All three kinds of conservatives or liberals, you know, have this big difference on openness. So those things go across, whether you're economic conservative, social conservative, or just plain I'm a conservative.
Right, but so let's stay for a second on the difference between fiscal and socially conservative. You are absolutely right, of course, that they are currently aligned, mm-hmm. dramatically so in the American landscape. But that's also a fairly recent thing, right? I mean, this
right.
goes back basically to the Reagan years.
What's happened is people are better sorted than they used to be.
Right.
You know? So we had more independence. We had less ideological homogeneity. We had So things were different. There's been a movement over the past several decades, and people have talked a lot about what caused it. I mean, I view it as basically the growth of the religious right. The increasing authoritarianism of the Republican Party. But yeah, they're pretty tightly interwoven now, and because people are so well sorted with psychology and ideology defining the parties, it's harder and harder for them to see eye to eye anymore.
So let's talk for a second about the other side of the political spectrum. What about liberals, which of course liberals, just like conservatives, are actually multidimensional. I mean, you can be, again, liberal about certain things and not so liberal about other things. But let's talk about some people that I know who are on the liberal side of the spectrum by any definition of the term, and yet they're just as anti-science as some people on the right. I'm thinking about people who reject, you know, the connection between vaccines and who thinks that there's a connection between vaccines and autism. Truthers, for instance, people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job. Mm-hmm. Most of those people tend actually to be on the fringe left, on the extreme left, mm-hmm, of the political spectrum.
The vaccines and autism link, I was surprised to learn there wasn't actually a liberal conservative split on
mixed.
That.
It's mixed.
Yeah, the 9/11 truthers, maybe. I don't know.
I'll give you truthers are more on the left. Yeah, I'll give you that one. And I would have expected the vaccine one to be more on the left, but the data keeps not obeying me. So
okay. Well, other examples are obvious. I mean, there's a lot of new age sort of kind of beliefs that tend to be more on the left side. Typically, also belief in the paranormal, in certain aspects of the paranormal, because there seems to be a negative correlation, for instance, between being a very conservative Christian and believing in the paranormal for a variety of reasons that actually people have gotten into it. Like, you know, it's not kosher to believe in ghosts and things like that if you're a conservative Christian.
Makes good sense.
Yeah. So the issue is, what about those people? Aren't they also sort of anti-fact and anti-science in some important sense of the term?
Right. So, yes. Just to be brief, yes. I think that
we don't want you to be that brief.
Getting there for different reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that whether the two sides are behaving this way to the same extent is quite debatable. But there's no doubt that you can get it on the left. And to explain that, I mean, I think that, you know, to some extent you can go with the standard, you know, you can infer it from some of the personality aspects. But I think that more enlightening is this research on moral systems and how they differ on the left and basically differ from left to right. And then what you find is that liberals, you know, they get very emotional about issues related to equality, fairness, and people who are vulnerable being harmed. And you know, emotions drive reasoning, and conservatives get very emotional about different things. But if you get liberals emotional about those things, and then it turns out that the facts aren't actually aligned properly, they can get very fired up about, you know, something that ends up being a wild goose chase. And so generally when you find these left anti-science things, you're going to find an emotion behind it that relates to equality or relates to some sense of, you know, the weak being abused, poisoned by some corporate power. So it aligns with left emotions. And that's where you'd expect to find it, and that's where you actually do find it.
That's an interesting point. I haven't thought about it that way. I mean, that you're referring to the work by Jonathan Haidt, right? On the different,
right? This is his breakdown. And then, of course, you'll find, and so just as you find that on the left, then on the right, where their biases are toward the in group as opposed to the out group.
Yeah,
and they do that more strongly towards authority and towards sexual purity. Not something that you find strong emotions about on the left.
No,
and then, you know, layoff regulating the economy is one of the ones that he's now put into his analysis.
Yeah.
So it's different. It's different emotions. And one of the key issues that's not resolved is what is the relationship between the personalities and the moral systems, and what comes first? I mean, they clearly both vary reliably from left to right, and how are they related to each other? And, you know, there's not a really satisfactory answer to that. But I mean, I have my quote theories about it. There do seem to be some relationships between them.
So I'm having a little bit of trouble squaring. So your the idea that the left-leaning rejection of facts has to do with, I mean, I'm sure in some sense it has to do with emotional reactions of a different way, of a different type. But let's say, let's go back again to, say, a tendency for New Age belief as opposed to a tendency for, you know, fundamentalist Christian belief. I mean, to me, they both seem to be, you know, equally rational. But I can actually much more easily see how the fundamentalist right is related to certain types of emotions that I associate stereotypically, let's say, with being conservative, as opposed to the New Age belief having this a similar kind of explanation. I mean, why would there be a connection between accepting some New Age view of the world and so being you know emotionally attached to equality, for instance, or something like that.
Well, let's spin it out. I agree it's easier with the fundamentalists. I mean, okay. And, you know, fundamentalist beliefs are providing closure, right? I mean,
right.
That's what's going on. It's yeah. quite simple. I mean, you know, New Age beliefs. Let's take one. I mean, would you accept alternative medicine as a New Age belief, or what are you looking for there?
Yeah, sure. Homeopathy, for instance.
Sure.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that'll be one. Or the power of crystals, you know, that sort of stuff.
I mean, I'm just when I think about the rejection of scientific medicine and embrace of unproven alternative modalities, I feel like I see liberal. I mean, first of all, we know that this stuff is more clustered in the coasts where liberals are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also I feel like I see liberal emotion shot through it. I mean, basically, there's a sense that current healthcare system is corporatized, and so therefore unfair. Okay. So there's your quality, unfair and harmful in the sense that it abuses, people with less money, who are more vulnerable, taking advantage of them. So mm-hmm. what are we going to do? We're going to find some other healthcare system that's more egalitarian, that takes care of everybody, that's warmer, more nurturing. And so there, here we have it. We've got this alternative form of, you know, getting medical care, which whatever you might say about it, I think it does tend to try to make people feel, you know, cared for, paid attention to. It's not corporate. It's not treating them like a statistic. You see what I'm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see that would be a testable hypothesis of some sort. You know, you probably have interesting historical data there to look at. For instance, the rise of New Age beliefs in the 1960s and 70s during the, you know, so the liberation movements and all that. And that was mm-hmm. certainly before there was any serious discussion of healthcare in this country. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can see how you can test that sort of hypothesis.
I can see some other connections too that seem plausible, like the love of and trust for natural things,
right.
things that you know, tribal peoples used
yeah.
instead of corporations. The you know, emotional preference for things like that, and the sort of noble savage mentality that goes along with that, seems related to the you know, opposition to colonialism and top-down power and war and things like that.
But you see how you can be very, like, psychologically open-minded and still, like, really dig this kind of thing. You know, your rationality is not going to lean toward the fundamentalist type. It's going to go in a different direction.
Yeah, it's going to go in the direction that Carl Sagan famously put in terms of, you know, if your mind is too open, your brain is going to fall off.
Right.
This is sort of the opposite extreme. I want to ask you one question that that is going to lead me to a second topic, which I think is going to be one of the most controversial in your book, which is the genetic part. But before we get to the genetic part, as a matter of curiosity, I'm not as familiar, of course, with sort of psychological and social literature as I am with similar kinds of literatures, however, in biology, like in ecology and evolutionary biology, for instance. And what I know from that literature is that whenever people come up with sort of models, explanatory models for complex phenomena, very often these models do work and, you know, they're statistically significant and all that. But the percentage of variation explained tend to be pretty small. And so as a matter of question, so here, for instance, what is your sense of, you know, how much explanatory power does something like personality profiles or brain scans and all that have on the actual beliefs that are held by people? I mean, I'm sure there is a statistically significant connection, but is it, are we explaining, you know, 3% of the variants, 10%, 90% of the variants? What are we talking about?
Well, so, not a statistician, read a lot of these papers, and of course the, you know, the amount of variance that's being explained is always varying. Mm-hmm. But you're never, with these things, getting 90% of the variance.
Right.
Okay, so just throw that out.
Yes, right. So 90 is out.
That's definitely okay. Not happening. What we're talking about, and again, I mean, I wish I had something in front of me to refer to, because in the book, I deliberately don't use a lot of statistics, although at one point we did, actually, and if I could open it, I could have given you a real helpful answer. But what we're really talking about is something like, let's say, a correlation between personality and a political view of 0.3 to 0.5, you know, at most, really.
Yeah. I mean, and that's 0.5 just one way
of saying
strong,
that there's
actually
all kinds of other things.
Yeah, yeah, no,
go,
but that's
go into the mix, right?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, right.
So it's moderately, it's not like extremely strongly correlated.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, you know, social scientists will say to you that to get that kind of correlation, given how complex the world is, and given how, you know, how much people vary, and given the some of the problems with the measuring when you're using it, what are essentially, you know, self-report.
Right. No, absolutely. So, but that wasn't, in fact, it was not meant as a criticism. It was meant to sort of put things into perspective, because actually the kind of answer you just gave, you know, a correlation between, you know, 0.2, 0.3, that sort of stuff, it's in fact exactly the sort of the range that you get also in other areas, that other scientific areas where there is studies of complex phenomena that are presumably caused by multiple causes, such as in ecology and evolution. Now, for our listeners, I would point out that, let's say, a correlation of 0.5, which sounds, it is, and that's not, doesn't sound, it is pretty high, it still is equivalent to about 25% of the variance explained, because the way you get that is simply the square of the correlation coefficient. So we're talking about a significant amount of variance, but that still means that even with a correlation coefficient of 0.5, you got 75% of the variation that is not unexplained or is explained by other causes. The reason I brought that up is because I assume, again, this is from my experience in a separate but not too distant field, I assume that when we get to the genetic, the thing gets even worse. Let me give you one of my favorite examples, which is the ongoing research to find genes underlying the tendency for homosexuality, right? Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, a lot of homosexuals themselves today will actually tell you that, yes, it's very likely there is a genetic component. You know, they don't feel like they have a choice, you know, that sort of stuff. Even so, whenever people have actually looked at, you know, try to identify genes that are actually correlated significantly with the development of a homosexual lifestyle within a family tree, they find them. But first of all, they find a lot of them. They scatter all over the genome. And each one of these genes tends to be either present in only one particular population. For instance, there was a famous case a few years ago of a group of families in Scandinavia. But the same gene, when they looked into other populations, was not correlated with homosexuality. And when they find them, these genes explain something like it on the order of, you know, 1 or 2% of the actual variation in the phenotype. Which doesn't mean they're not important. They're there. The correlation is statistically significant. But it does mean that, of course, they leave quite a bit of variation out there for other explanatory causes. Is that a similar case also for what the research you looked into between personality? You know, I'm talking now about the genetics of personality.
Just to be clear, you're saying that they're finding one gene that's explaining like a percent or something?
Yeah,
like that?
1 or 2%, right.
Mm-hmm. For homosexuality?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just to make sure I got it right, because if so, that would be better than anybody's finding in politics.
Okay. So we're talking about smaller numbers than that then.
Right. Well, I mean, but I don't think anyone expected to be finding any single genes with large effects.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's not what you would expect for a complex social trait like politics.
Right.
But on the other hand, I explain in the book, when they do twin studies, which is how you know, one of the traditional ways of trying to find out whether a trait is partly genetic, then, you know, they definitely find that politics, religion, etc., all these things that we think, oh my God, that's your upbringing. And it turns out that no, they always find a significant genetic component to them. But that doesn't mean that it's one gene. It's probably a huge number of genes. And the search is on to find them. And that there's at least one paper published claiming to have found a liberal gene. But, I mean, you know, it's not like, I'm not even sure that's accepted. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that it would explain much of anything is, I think, you know, overdoing it. So I just wanted to give you a little bit more on terms of how much personality does explain politics, because mm-hmm. you asked the statistical question, and I want to tell you how I broke down, explained one of the studies. This is a Yale study of personality in politics.
Right.
And so this is how I wrote it, and I just want to be precise. People who rated very high on openness were on average more liberal in outlook than 71% of the respondents. Mm-hmm. And someone who rated very high on conscientiousness was on average more conservative in outlook than 61% mm-hmm. of the respondents.
And what's an example?
And that ended up being as much as or more of an effect than education on your politics.
And what's an example of
education pushes you to the left. Everybody knows this. And the upshot was that, well, personality does too. We just don't we don't talk about that nearly as much.
Okay, third try. What's an example of a question that someone would get asked to demonstrate their openness or their conscientiousness, just to give our listeners a sense of what you're talking about here?
I view myself as cleanly. I view myself as highly organized. Those are some conscientiousness questions uh-huh. that you might get. And let me actually, I have a PowerPoint slide, and I'm just going to actually read you some of them.
Great.
So if, you know, an openness question would be, how much do you agree with the statement, I see myself as artistic, a mm-hmm. highly abstract thinker, and you rate 1 to 7 from agree strongly to disagree strongly. And a conscientiousness question would be, I see myself as dependable, self-disciplined, and you rate yourself 1 to 7. How much mm-hmm. do you agree, disagree? Mm-hmm. Another openness question would say, I see myself as open to new experiences, complex, agree or disagree.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of thing that they do. And they do the same things with, you know, I see myself as extroverted, enthusiastic, agree, disagree. And you go through the list. So these are subjective, people reporting what they're like. But, I mean, there's a pretty well-established science of doing this.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I have an alternative hypothesis I wanted to propose. So mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that your thesis was that there's this causal arrow pointing from these personality traits to, you know, beliefs on these questions of fact. What if it were the case that the actual determinants of people's beliefs in these questions of fact was their tribe, basically their social, familial environment. And that also determined their personality traits. So you would have a common cause, but, you know, there wouldn't actually be a causal arrow going from personality traits to wrongness.
Let me see if I understand correctly what Julia is asking. So you're suggesting the possibility that what appears to be a correlation between, the observable correlation between, let's say, personality traits in certain positions, political positions, mm-hmm. may actually be the result of a common factor that is influencing both.
Right, and so correlation without causation.
Right, and that common factor, well, there would be causation once removed, right? So say that there's a third factor. In this case, you're thinking of familiality, essentially. Actually, there's a term for that.
Your family, your right. social circle,
your social environment,
the people
right.
you interact with yeah, would cause both your, you know, level of conscientiousness or openness to new experiences and also your, right. you know, beliefs in these factual right. issues.
Chris, what do you think?
First of all, So I don't doubt that to some extent that is happening, but you got to remember, first of all, the Republicans, conservatives are more tribal. I mean, that's one of the you know, results of Jonathan Haidt's work, is that they perceive more of a difference between the in-group and the out-group. And so if that were the case, then you would think, if what you're saying is the case, you would expect the two sides to be symmetrical in how much they are biased towards their own side and biased against the other side.
Right.
But another thing that the book does is piece together together a lot of the evidence showing all these asymmetric responses. And I was just doing an interview with a political scientist about this today. In terms of approval ratings for the president of the opposite party, willingness to credit that a president of the opposite party actually did well on the economy when there was good economic news. He was saying that, the Republicans are just more negative on the president of the opposite party.
Yeah, I've actually looked at the same research.
Just another result that just came out, it was a study of conspiracy theories, and there were two that were held on more on the left and two that were held more on the right. And so one of the ones on the left was trutherism. One of the ones on the right was thinking that Obama was not born in the United States, or that he's lying about his past, et cetera. And then there were other ones. And again, what they were finding was that, first of all, Republicans believe the Obama lie much, much more than Democrats believe the truther lie. But also, it was only in Republicans that knowing more about politics made you more likely to believe the conspiracy. But on the Democratic side, the more you know, the more the fog is lifted and you don't believe this nonsense anymore. Mm-hmm. If you go through and you look at all the research, some of which has come out since the book, you keep finding these very suggestive asymmetries. Mm-hmm. And I don't purport to say that the science is completely in on why we keep finding them. But on the other hand, I'm very happy to say that they keep turning up. I'll tell you about some more if you want. They keep turning up, and it's very plausible to think that they might be rooted partly in psychology, given that you have psychological differences that you would think would lend themselves to this kind of thing to begin with. So that's my view on the matter.
But just to be clear, I don't think that their view is incompatible, however, with as you pointed out yourself, with a number of causes interacting into eventually yielding the final result, which is, what's your opinion about this or that particular political subject matter? Meaning that, first of all, if we start with the observation that, with the claim that people are different, let's say their brains work differently, and that explains why they have different opinions. That's at that level, that's almost a truism. I mean, it has to be the case, right? We formulate our opinions through our brains, presumably. So if we have different opinions,
I like to use my feet, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some people may be using other organs, but presumably you will find some differences in their brains. The deeper question, of course, is, well, are those differences in the brain more stable over the lifetime? Now we're talking about personality as opposed to superficial differences. And then that even deeper question is, well, could some of that actually be genetic and therefore be the result of, evolutionary forces? And it seems to me that the more we get removed from the what I refer to as a superficial aspect of analysis, but I don't mean that in a demeaning sense. I mean literally as in closer to the surface of what the brain does. As the more we move from the sort of description of differences in the functionality of the brains of different individuals to sort of the extreme level, the more remote level of the genetic analysis, clearly we lose a lot of percentage of explanatory power, essentially, because we're having a lot of more causal pathways that are going to interact. So the picture that seems to emerge then in the end is that human behavior is in fact the result of some genetic influences, some personality. Personality surely is partly genetic, part the result of the kind of phenomena that Julia was talking about, that is the familiarity, the kind of environment in which you grow up. And of course, part of it is still shaped throughout your life. I mean, I'm sure that I have a slightly different personality, at least from what I had, 20 or 30 years ago. I certainly have different opinions on a number of things from what I had 20 or 30 years ago. So how does this kind of scheme therefore explain, for instance, the fact that people do change their mind? I mean, there's evidence of that, I hope, right? So are you saying that certain personality types are more likely statistically to change their mind in certain things, or maybe there is the scope of what they are willing to change their mind about that is different, or both?
I think that in general, openness to new experience implies more of a willingness to listen to other perspectives and take them seriously. I think that that's part of openness. The question is, again, complicated, because I think everyone can change, and I think situations change people. And I think situations, to some extent, cause people to change their personalities. Also, interestingly, I mean, there's some reason to think that it's sort of, if you have high need for closure, you need a firm answer. Sometimes that can be the kind of person who will go from one radical extreme to the other, as situations change, and flip entirely, and find a different kind of firm, all-encompassing kind of answer that might be very different from one that they used to believe before. So the question of change is, I think, really interesting. But nothing about this, to me, argues against the possibility of change. I mean, and I think the most interesting kind of change, and the kind of change that I think most affirms this whole approach, is the fascinating phenomenon of liberals getting more conservative, you know, in different situations, largely because of some psychological pressure. You know, either the country's under attack, they want a strong leader, they start to act conservative because they fear for their lives, just like conservatives do. But it's been made more salient to them. Right. But, you know, some of the other manipulations that tend to make liberals more conservative are being primed to think of bodily cleanliness. You know, there's a study on that. Yeah. One of the concurrent themes we didn't talk about with conservatives is all this, you know, need for physical cleanliness and sexual purity. And, you know, to some extent, it seems that priming liberals with those thoughts leads them to answer questions more conservatively.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that kind of change, too. And, right. and what it all suggests is that all these insensible factors in the environment are interacting with the nature of the person at the particular point in time and are pulling them towards different ideologies right. and different outcomes. And we're not conscious of a lot of what's happening.
There's also another factor, actually, that I would assume, I'm going to make a guess here, that is actually predictable of a statistical tendency to change from more liberal to more conservative, and that's simply age. A lot of people become more conservative when they become older, and whether that is because suddenly they become, you know, they have children, they have investment into certain things that are, they become more afraid of losing or something like that, or perhaps they've been, you know, it's the cumulative experience of their lifetime or whatever it is. That's obviously not always the case. I mean, I know perfectly well that there's people who start out as liberal and end up as liberal through the end of their life. But there's a good number of at least anecdotal cases that I know of, and it'd be nice to see if there is actual evidence of that trajectory, because that goes back to one of the original questions about, you know, how much does personality change through time. But
just a brief tangent, that that doesn't contradict Chris's theory if, as people age, they also, that causes them to become less willing to change their minds, and that's what causes them to be unwilling to update on new evidence.
Right. It's just one more. It's just one more dimension to the problem. I have one more question before Julie is going to tell us that we have to wrap it up, which is, okay, so given the framework that you lay out in the book, do you have any suggestions on how to improve the situation that we started with, which is this, you know, complete lack of understanding and dialogue in American politics these days? Can we do anything about it, given your particular framework?
We could. I mean, but to affect mass change, you'd have to have mass awareness of all of this. And, you know, if there's anybody who's terrified of it, it's the media, because it, you know, exposes their, you know, fallacious, even-handed behavior as not really responsible. And so you don't get serious treatment of this kind of understanding of what's really driving politics. But if you did, if it was widely understood, and it isn't remotely the case right now, if it was widely understood that we adopt our political predispositions based on a variety of personality-related and emotional factors of which we are not consciously aware and not necessarily in control, then I would think that, oh, and by the way, my neighbor might just end up doing it differently than me for reasons that are hard to determine and not necessarily under my neighbor's control. I would think that that would lead people to say to their political opponent, you know, there but for whatever kinds of factors, I could have gone. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you know, maybe it's just part of the way things work that we have these liberals and we have these conservatives and we have these libertarians, and they just kind of, you know, the world kind of spits them out. And, you know, that's just the way it is. And I think that that would lead to a perspective that would be more able to credit that, you know, that's the way they are. It's not something we can really change. It's not something that's worth demonizing because it's always been thus. I would think that that would lead to more productive kinds of conversations if people really wrap their mind around that reality. But we're so far from a world in which that's, you know, taken to be the case and accepted that it's hard to imagine what that world would be like.
Chris, before we wrap up, I wanted to commend you sincerely because
you.
At the end, well, you don't know yet what you're being commended for, but,
but that's okay. You'll take it.
Well, at the end of the book, you report some new results of a psychological study that you helped conduct, testing hypotheses related to the thesis of your book. And the results were partially confirmatory and partially not. And I always admire it when people publish results that don't completely confirm their theory.
Oh, well, thank you. No, we had to do that. And, you know, that study is trying to get at the relationship between biased reasoning and these basic psychological predispositions that are related to ideology. And, yeah, we didn't, I mean, research continues, but we thought we had a design that could really capture something that would let people say, aha, and we didn't have that, you know. Well, it didn't give us what we expected, such as science.
Way to set a good example
there.
Yeah,
we had to publish that. It would have been really lame not to, you know.
Good for you. We are now over time, so let's wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking Picks. I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that if you're a fan of the Rationally Speaking podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this year's Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which will be held in New York, New York, the weekend of April 5th through 7th, 2013. Go to nexus.org now to get your tickets. They're on sale. In addition to Massimo and I, you'll also find a lineup of great speakers, including the SGU, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, and our keynote speaker, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Drunkard's Walk. Nexus.org, that's NECSS.org. Go get your tickets now.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Chris Mooney, for his suggestion. Chris.
Yeah, well, I'll just recommend the book that I've read most recently that I really enjoyed. I read Maria Konnikova's book, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was awesome. You know, it's about sort of how to change your consciousness and the way you respond to the world so that you live a little better because you are more engaged and you're less just sort of letting things happen to you and letting your brain process them unconsciously and a little bit more aware of what your brain is actually up to. And I realized reading it what part of my life I was actually good at doing that in. And it really surprised me where my brain is trained, especially. And it turned out that, you know, I'd been a bird watcher. So I realized that when I go through life, I'm always looking and seeing things that other people aren't seeing around them that are happen to be birds because I've trained my brain to do it. And it made me think, oh, how could I possibly do this with other things that I do? And of course, the idea is that Sherlock Holmes is like this, right? He's trained himself so that he can see all these things and not be buffeted around by whatever happens, but have more control of it. So I thought it was really fascinating.
That's great to hear, Chris. And I, as a former bird watcher, when I was, you know, 11, 12 years old, I always resented that bird watching wasn't given sufficient respect and admiration in society. So if we can just spread this message widely that you can be more like Sherlock Holmes if you just spend a little time bird watching, then, you know, 11-year-old Julia would be pleased to hear that. Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.